The Castle by Franz Kafka, continued.
Disc 5.
I'm not moving, said Kay. You certainly are my superior, but not the person who granted me this position. That was the council chairman, and he's the only one from whom I shall accept notification of dismissal. Now, he hardly gave me this position so that I and these people of mine should freeze here, but rather, as you yourself said, to prevent me from engaging in rash acts of despair. Letting me go now would be directly contrary to his intentions, and I refuse to believe it till I hear the opposite from his own lips. It is decidedly in your interest that I should refuse to accept such a frivolous dismissal.
So you refuse? Asked the teacher. Kay shook his head. Think this over carefully, said the teacher. You don't always make the wisest decisions. Just recall, for instance, your refusal to submit to questioning yesterday afternoon.
Why do you bring that up now? Asked Kay.
Because I'm so inclined, said the teacher, and I'm telling you this now for the last time. Get out.
But since this had no effect, the teacher went to the desk and spoke softly to the schoolmistress. She said something about the police, but the teacher dismissed this, and they finally agreed on a solution. The teacher told the children to go to his classroom, where they would receive instruction with the other children. This diversion pleased all, the room emptied amid laughter and shouting, with the teacher and schoolmistress following behind. The schoolmistress carried the class register, on which lay the amply proportioned and utterly indifferent cat. The teacher would have rather left the cat there, but the schoolmistress rejected a suggestion along those lines with a vehement allusion to Kay's cruelty. So, on top of all the other irritations, Kay was now burdening the teacher with the cat. This surely left its mark on the last words spoken by the teacher, which he addressed to Kay from the doorway. "The lady has no choice but to leave this room with the children, since you refuse in a refractory manner to accept my notification of dismissal, and since nobody can expect a young girl like her to impart lessons amidst your dirty family shambles. So you'll stay here on your own, and since you'll no longer have the revulsion of decent onlookers to contend with, you may stretch out as you please. But it won't last long, I can guarantee that."
Chapter 12. The Assistants. No sooner had they all left than Kay said to the assistants, "Go away." Baffled by this unexpected command, they complied, but when Kay locked the door behind them, they immediately tried to come back in and began whimpering and knocking on the door.
"You're dismissed," Kay cried. "I will never employ you in my service again."
They weren't willing to accept this, though, and hammered with their hands and feet on the door.
"Let us come back to you, sir," they cried, as if Kay were the land and they were about to sink in the floods. But Kay had no sympathy for them. He waited impatiently for the moment when the unbearable noise would force the teacher to intervene. This soon happened.
"Let those damned assistants of yours in," he shouted. "I've dismissed them."
Kay shouted back. This had the undesired side effect of showing the teacher what happened when one actually had the strength not only to give notice of dismissal, but to enforce the dismissal. The teacher now attempted, in an amicable way, to soothe the assistants. They need only wait here calmly, for Kay would finally have to let them back in again. Then he left. And the situation would have remained quiet if Kay hadn't begun shouting to them that they were dismissed and hadn't the slightest hope of reinstatement. At that, they began to make as much noise as before. The teacher came back, but he would no longer negotiate with them, and instead drove them, evidently with his greatly feared cane, from the school. Before long, they appeared at the windows of the gymnasium, knocking on the panes and shouting, but their words were no longer audible. Yet they didn't stay there long, either. In the deep snow, they couldn't jump about as much as their restlessness demanded. So they rushed to the fence of the school garden, jumped up on the stone base, where, though only from afar, they could get a better view of the room. There they ran up and down, holding onto the fence, then halted, and stretched their clasped hands beseechingly toward Kay. They kept this up a long time, despite the futility of their efforts. It was as if they were blind, and they probably didn't even stop when Kay lowered the curtains to get them out of his sight. In the now dusky room, Kay went to the parallel bars to see about Frida. At a glance from him, she got up, tidied her hair, dried her face, and silently set about making coffee. Although she already knew about all this, Kay nonetheless gave her formal notice of his dismissal of the assistants. She merely nodded. Kay sat down on a school bench and observed her weary movements. It had always been her freshness and resolve that had lent her paltry body a certain beauty, but now that beauty was gone. It had taken only a few days of living with Kay to bring this about.
The work in the taproom hadn't been easy, but it probably suited her better. Or was the distance from Clam the real reason for her decline? Clam's proximity had made her so madly enticing. In that enticement, Kay had seized her, but now she was wilting in his arms. "Frida," said Kay. She put the coffee mill down at once and came to Kay on the bench.
"You're angry at me?" she asked.
"No," said Kay. "I think you cannot help it. You were quite content living at the gentleman's inn. I should have left you there."
"Yes," said Frida, gazing sadly into space. "You should have left me there. I'm not worthy enough to live with you. Freed of me, you could perhaps achieve everything you want. Out of concern for me, you submit to that tyrannical teacher, take on this miserable post, and now you are making a painstaking application for an interview with Clam. All for me, but I give you little in return."
"No," said Kay, putting his arm around her consolingly. "Those are merely trifles that don't hurt me, and it isn't just for you that I want to go to Clam. And then there's everything you have done for me. Before getting to know you, I was very much adrift here. Nobody took me in, and anybody I thrust myself upon soon made me leave. And even if I could have found peace with certain people, it could only have been with those I ought to have fled from, like Barnabas's family."
"You fled from them? Isn't that so, darling?"
Frida broke in quite animatedly, and then, after a hesitant "yes" from Kay, fell back into her weariness. By now, though, Kay was no longer so determined to explain how everything had taken a turn for the better for him through the alliance with Frida. Slowly he took his arm away. They sat a moment in silence, and then, as if Kay's hand had supplied her with a warmth that she now found indispensable, she said,
"I cannot stand this life here. If you want to hold on to me, we must leave and go somewhere else, to southern France or to Spain."
"I cannot go abroad," said Kay. "I came here in order to stay here. I will stay here." And in a contradiction he didn't bother to explain, he added, as if speaking to himself, "Now what could have attracted me to this desolate land, other than the desire to stay?" Then he said, "But you too want to stay here. It is your country. All you miss is Clam, and that prompts such desperate thoughts."
"So I miss Clam," said Frida. "There's surely an abundance of Clam here, too much Clam. It's so as to escape from him that I want to get away. It isn't Clam that I miss, but you. It's for your sake that I want to leave, because I cannot get enough of you here, where everybody is constantly tearing at me. Better to have this pretty mask torn off, better to have this body made ugly, so that I can live with you in peace."
Kay noted only one thing. "So Clam is still in touch with you?" he asked at once. "He calls you?"
"I know nothing about Clam," said Frida. "I'm talking about others, for instance, the assistants."
"Oh, the assistants," Kay said in astonishment. "They follow you?"
"Did you never notice it, then?" asked Frida.
"No," said Kay, vainly trying to recall some details. "They surely are intrusive, lecherous young lads, but I never noticed their having the audacity to go near you."
"You never did?" said Frida. "You never noticed how impossible it was to get them out of our room at the Bridge Inn? How jealously they observed our relations? How one of them lay in my place on the straw mattress, how they testified against you so as to drive you away, ruin you, and have me to themselves? You didn't notice any of that?"
Kay looked at Frida without answering. These charges against the assistants were surely true, but they could also be interpreted much more innocently as a reflection of the assistants' ridiculous, childish, unstable, uncontrollable nature. And wasn't it further proof against the accusation that they should have always endeavoured to go with Kay instead of staying behind with Frida? Kay mentioned something of the sort.
"Hypocrisy," said Frida. "You didn't see through it? Then why did you drive them away, if not for those reasons?"
And she went to the window, pulled the curtain slightly to one side, looked out, and called to Kay. The assistants were still outside at the fence. Visibly tired though they were, summoning all their energy, they extended their arms beseechingly every now and then toward the schoolhouse. One of them, in order to avoid having to keep holding on, impaled the back of his coat on the fence.
"Poor things, poor things," said Frida.
"You asked me why I drove them away?" Kay asked. "You're directly to blame for that."
"Me?"
Frida asked, without taking her eyes from the window. "You were all too friendly toward the assistants," said Kay. "You tolerated their bad habits, laughed at them, stroked their hair, pitied them constantly."
Poor things, you've just said so again.
And then finally that last incident, since you believed I wasn't too high a price to pay for getting the assistants out of a beating."
"Well, that's just it," said Frida. "That's what I'm talking about. That's exactly what makes me so unhappy, what keeps me from you, even though I know of no greater happiness than to be with you, constantly, without interruption, without end. But in the dreams I dream, there's no tranquil place on earth for our love in the village or anywhere else. So I picture a deep and narrow grave where we embrace each other as if with clamps. I hide my face in you, you hide yours in me, and nobody will ever see us again. But then, look at those assistants. It isn't you they are thinking of when they clasp their hands like that, but me."
"And it's not me who is watching them," said Kay, "but you."
"Of course it's me," said Frida, almost angrily. "But that's what I have been telling you all along. Why else would the assistants be pursuing me, even if they are the emissaries of Clam?"
"The emissaries of Clam," said Kay, for though the term immediately seemed quite natural to him, it still came as a big surprise.
"Yes, of course, Clam's emissaries," said Frida. "But even if they are, they're still clumsy youths whose education could profit from a beating. What ugly, swarthy youths, and how repulsive the contrast between their faces, which make one see them as adults, or almost as students, and their childish, silly behaviour. Do you think I can't see this? I am ashamed of them. But that's exactly it. They don't repel me. I'm ashamed of them. I can't stop looking at them. When one ought to get annoyed at them, I can only laugh. When one ought to strike them, I can only stroke their hair. When I lie beside you at night, unable to sleep, I cannot help looking across you and observing one of them sleeping tightly rolled up in the blanket, and the other kneeling by the open oven door stoking the fire, and I must bend so far forward that I almost wake you. And it isn't the cat that frightens me. No, I know all about cats, and I know all about those uneasy, constantly interrupted naps in the taproom. It's not the cat that frightens me, but I, who give myself a fright. And it doesn't take that monster of a cat, for I jump at the least noise. One moment I'm afraid you'll wake up and it'll be all over, and the next I'm jumping up to light the candle so you'll wake up quickly and protect me."
"I had no idea about any of those things," said Kay, "though in an inkling of it I drove them away. But now that they're gone, perhaps everything will be fine."
"Yes, they're finally gone," said Frida,
though her face was tormented rather than joyful.
"But we don't know who they are. Clam's emissaries, that's what I call them in my thoughts, just playfully. But perhaps that is what they really are. Their eyes, those naive but sparkling eyes, somehow remind me of Clam's eyes. Yes, that's it. Clam's glance sometimes leaps from their eyes and goes straight through me. And so it was wrong of me to have said that I'm ashamed of them. I only wish that were so, though I realize that in other places and with other people this same conduct would be stupid and offensive. With them it isn't. I watch their silly antics with admiration and respect. But if they are Clam's emissaries, who will free us from them? And would it be even good to be freed from them? Wouldn't you have to bring them back in at once and be happy if they actually came?"
"You want me to let them back in?" Kay asked.
"No, no," said Frida. "Nothing could be further from my wishes. The sight of them, if they were to burst in now, their delight in seeing me again, their hopping about like children and their stretching out their arms like men, I might not be able to bear that. But then, when I think that if you keep treating them this harshly, you may be denying Clam access to you, I want to save you from the repercussions of that. Then I want you to let them in. So quickly, let them in. Don't worry about me. What difference do I make? I will defend myself for as long as I can. But if I lose, well, then I lose, but with the awareness that this, too, was for your sake."
"You're only reinforcing my opinion about the assistants," said Kay. "They will never come in here again with my permission. The fact that I got them out shows that under certain circumstances it is indeed possible to curb them, and that they have no significant business with Clam. Only yesterday evening I got a letter from Clam, from which it emerges that Clam has been completely misinformed about the assistants, and the only conclusion this permits is that he is utterly indifferent to them, for if this weren't so he could certainly have obtained precise information about them. The fact that you see Clam in the assistants proves nothing, for unfortunately you're still influenced by the landlady and see Clam everywhere. You're still Clam's mistress, and not my wife yet, by any means. This sometimes makes me feel quite dismal. Then it's as if I had lost everything. Then I have the feeling I have just arrived in the village, not full of hope, as I truly was then, but aware that nothing but disappointments lie ahead, and that I will have to drink each one down to the dregs. But still, that's only sometimes," Kay added, smiling, when he saw Frida sag under his words. "Besides, it does underline something positive, namely what you mean to me. And if you call upon me to choose between you and the assistants, then the assistants have already lost. What an idea, to choose between you and the assistants. Now I want to get rid of them once and for all. Who knows, perhaps the weakness that came over the two of us simply comes from our not having had breakfast yet."
"Possibly,"
said Frida, smiling wearily, and she set to work. Kay, too, picked up his broom again. Chapter 13 Hans. A little while later there was a light knock.
"Barnabas!"
Kay shouted, threw down the broom, and in a few bounds was at the door. Frida, startled more by the name than by anything else, looked at him. With his unsteady hands, Kay couldn't immediately open the old lock. "I'm opening it," he kept repeating, instead of asking who was knocking. And then he had to watch entering through the now wide-open front door not Barnabas, but the small boy who had once wanted to speak to Kay. But Kay had no desire to remember him. "Well, what are you doing here?" he said. "Classes are next door."
"I came from there," said the boy, looking up at Kay with large brown eyes, erect, his arms close to his body.
"So what do you want? Quick,"
said Kay, bending down a little, for the boy spoke softly.
"Can I help you?"
asked the boy.
"He wants to help us," Kay said to Frida, and then to the boy, "So what's your name?"
"Hans Brunswick," said the boy. "Fourth grade, son of Otto Brunswick, master shoemaker, Madeline Street."
"Well then, your name is Brunswick," said Kay, who now became friendlier. It turned out that Hans had become so upset over the bloody welts the schoolmistress had raised on Kay's hand that he then had decided to help him. Without asking, he had, at the risk of severe punishment, crept from the other classroom like a deserter. He was, no doubt, largely driven by such boyish notions. They were matched by the earnestness evident in everything he did. Only initially hampered by shyness, he soon got used to Kay and Frida, and on being given good hot coffee to drink, he grew lively and confiding, and his questions eager and insistent, as if he wanted to ascertain the essential as quickly as possible in order to be able to make decisions for Kay and Frida on his own. There was also a certain imperiousness in his nature, but mixed with childish innocence, so that you were glad to submit to him, half sincerely, half jokingly. In any case, he monopolized everybody's attention. All work had ceased. Breakfast was dragging on. Although he was seated on a bench, Kay above at the teacher's table and Frida on a nearby chair, it looked as if Hans were the teacher, as if he were examining them and judging their answers. A faint smile around his soft mouth seemed to suggest he knew very well that this was merely a game, but this only made him concentrate all the more intently. Perhaps it wasn't so much a smile as the happiness of childhood that played about his lips. It took him a remarkably long time to admit that he knew Kay from the time he had come by Lazarman's. This pleased Kay.
"You were playing at the woman's feet?" Kay asked.
"Yes," said Hans. "That was my mother."
And now he had to speak about his mother, but he did so only hesitantly, after repeated requests. It became clear, though, that he was indeed a young boy, from whom, especially when he was asking questions, there seemed to issue a voice, perhaps in a premonition of the future, but perhaps this was merely a sensory illusion on the part of the uneasy, tense listener, the voice of an almost energetic, clever man with foresight. But then, without transition, he was once again a schoolboy who was incapable of understanding certain questions and misinterpreted others and spoke too softly, with a childish inconsiderateness, even though this failing was repeatedly pointed out to him, and then, faced with some especially penetrating questions, he fell quite silent, as though out of stubbornness, and also without the slightest embarrassment, in a way no adult could have done. Indeed, it seemed as if he thought that he alone was permitted to ask questions, and that questions from the others would only break some rule and waste time. He could sit there quietly for a long time, body erect, head lowered, lower lip pouting. This so pleased Frida that she often asked him questions in the hope that they would silence him in this way. Sometimes she even succeeded, but this annoyed Kay. On the whole, one didn't learn much. Hans's mother was rather sickly, but the exact nature of the illness was still unclear. The child that Frau Brunswick had been holding on her lap was Hans's sister and was called Frida. Hans wasn't pleased to discover that the woman questioning him had the same name. They all lived in the village, though not at Lazarman's. They had only gone there for a bath, since Lazarman had the large tub in which the small children, Hans no longer counted as such, loved to bathe and frolic. Hans spoke of his father with reverence or fear, but only when there was no mention of his mother. When set against his mother, his father evidently counted for little. Incidentally, no matter how you questioned him about his family life, he never responded. All you learned about his father's trade was that he was the largest shoemaker in the village. Nobody else came near, as Hans repeated often enough in response to entirely unrelated questions. The father even gave out work to other shoemakers, such as Barnabas's father.
but in that particular case Brunswick must have done so as a special favour, as indicated by the proud way Hans tossed his head, which made Frieda jump down and kiss him. Asked whether he had ever been at the castle, he answered only after repeated questioning, and what's more, with a no. When asked the same question concerning his mother, he simply did not answer. Kay finally wearied of this. The questioning seemed useless even to him, for in that respect he agreed with the boy. There was also something rather shameful about this effort to probe family secrets in a roundabout way through an innocent child, and indeed doubly so if you couldn't even come up with anything. And finally, when Kay asked the boy how he proposed to help, he was no longer surprised to learn that Hans merely wanted to help them with their tasks so as to ensure that the teacher and schoolmistress ceased scolding Kay. Kay explained to Hans that no such help was needed. It was probably in the teacher's nature to be a scold, and one could scarcely escape this even through the most meticulous work. The work itself wasn't that difficult, and only because of certain chance events had he fallen behind today. And in any case, this scolding didn't affect Kay as it would a pupil. He simply shook it off. It meant almost nothing to him, and he hoped to escape soon from the teacher. Since this merely concerned help against the teacher, Kay thanked him very much and said he could go back now. He hoped he wouldn't be punished. Although Kay never emphasized this and only intimated it involuntarily, it was only the help against the teacher that he didn't need, whereas he wasn't ruling out the possibility of another sort of help. Hans clearly took note of this and asked whether Kay needed help of some other kind. He would be very glad to help him, and if he couldn't, he would ask his mother to do so, and then success would be assured. Besides, when Father had worries, he also asked Mother for help. And Mother had once even asked about Kay. She hardly ever left the house. Her presence that day at Lazarman's was exceptional. But he, Hans, often went there to play with Lazarman's children, and Mother had once asked him whether the surveyor had ever come back. Well, one shouldn't ask Mother needless questions, for she was weak and ill. And so he had simply told her that he hadn't seen the surveyor there, and nothing more was said. On finding Kay here in the school, though, he had to speak to him so that he could inform his mother. For Mother liked it best if you carried out her wishes without explicit orders. At that, after a moment's reflection, Kay said he didn't need help. He had everything he needed, but it was very kind of Hans to want to help him, and he thanked him for his good intentions. It was certainly possible he might need something later, then he would turn to him. He did have his address. But this time maybe he, Kay, could be of some help. He was sorry that Hans's mother was ailing and that nobody here evidently understood her illness. In a case as badly neglected as this, even illnesses that are quite minor in and of themselves can become quite serious. Well, he, Kay, not only had some medical knowledge, but also, and this was even more valuable, experience treating patients. There were cases where doctors had failed and he had succeeded. At home, on account of his healing powers, they always called him the bitter herb. Anyhow, he would like to take a look at Hans's mother and talk to her. Perhaps he could give some good advice. He would gladly do so, even if only for Hans's sake. At first, Hans's eyes lit up at this offer, tempting Kay to become even more insistent, though the result was unsatisfactory, for in answer to repeated questions and without even expressing regret, Hans said that no strangers were allowed to visit Mother, since she needed constant care. Though Kay had barely spoken to her that one time, she had had to spend a few days in bed afterwards, but this was a frequent occurrence. Father had become very angry at Kay and would certainly never allow Kay to come and visit Mother. Indeed, he had actually wanted to go and see Kay in order to punish him for his behaviour, only Mother had dissuaded him. But above all, Mother herself generally didn't want to speak to anyone, and her question about Kay was no exception to that rule. On the contrary, in mentioning him she could have said that she wished to see him, but she had not done so, and had thus made her intentions plain. She only wanted to hear about Kay and didn't want to speak to him. By the way, it wasn't actually an illness she suffered from. She was fully aware of the cause of her condition and sometimes hinted as much. It was probably the air here that didn't agree with her, but then again, because of Father and the children, she didn't want to leave the village. And also her condition was much better than it had been. And this is all Kay learned. Hans's powers of reasoning had noticeably improved now that he had to shield his mother from Kay, the very person whom he supposedly wanted to help. Indeed, in the good cause of keeping Kay from his mother, he even contradicted some of his own previous statements, those, for instance, concerning her illness. Nonetheless, Kay could now see, too, that Hans still viewed him favourably, only he forgot everything else because of his mother. Anybody one happened to mention in the same breath as his mother immediately got put in the wrong. Just now it was Kay, but it could just as easily be someone like, say, his father. Kay wanted to test that last notion, and said that it was certainly very sensible of Hans's father to shield his mother from all disturbances, and if he, Kay, had had even the slightest inkling of that, he certainly wouldn't have risked speaking to his mother, and so he was asking Hans to convey his belated apologies to the family. Still, he couldn't quite understand why, if the causes of the illness were so clearly established, his father was preventing his mother from recovering in the air someplace else. One had to say that his father was preventing her, since it was only for his sake and the children's that she didn't go away. But she could take the children with her. She certainly needn't go away for long, nor very far, either, for up on the castle hill the air was entirely different. His father needn't fear the cost of such an excursion. He was, after all, the largest shoemaker in the village, and he or his mother surely had relatives or acquaintances at the castle who would gladly take her in. Why wouldn't he let her go? He shouldn't underestimate an ailment of that sort. Kay had caught only a glimpse of his mother, but it was her striking paleness and infirmity that had prompted him to speak to her. And even then he had been surprised that Hans's father had left that sick woman in the bad air of a room used for communal bathing and washing, and hadn't tempered his own loud voice either. His father probably didn't know what was at stake. It could be that the ailment had improved of late. That sort of ailment is fickle. But in the end, if you don't fight it, it gathers force and comes back, and nothing more can be done. Well, if Kay couldn't speak to Hans's mother, it would perhaps be a good idea to speak with his father and make him aware of all this. Hans had listened intently, understood most, and strongly sensed the threat in the remainder, which he found incomprehensible. Nonetheless, he said that Kay couldn't speak to father. Father disliked him, and would surely treat him as the teacher had done. All smiles and shyness when talking about Kay, he was all bitterness and grief whenever he mentioned his father. Yet he added that Kay could perhaps speak to mother, but only without father's knowledge. After reflecting for a moment with a fixed gaze, like a woman who wants to do something forbidden and seeks a way to carry it out with impunity, Hans said that it would perhaps be possible the day after tomorrow. In the evenings, father went to the gentleman's inn. He had meetings there, and so in the evening he, Hans, would come and lead Kay to mother, but only if mother agreed, which was still quite unlikely. Above all else, she never did anything contrary to father's will, submitted to him in everything, including matters whose unreasonableness even he, Hans, could clearly recognize. In reality, Hans was looking for Kay's help against his father. It was as if he had deceived himself, for he had thought that he wanted to help Kay, whereas what he had truly wanted, since nobody in their old circle could help them, was to determine whether this stranger, whose sudden appearance even mother had noted, might perhaps be able to help them. How unintentionally reserved and almost underhanded the boy was, one couldn't have gathered this from his appearance or his speech, only through the rather belated confessions extracted from him by chance or design. And now, in long conversations with Kay, he considered what difficulties had to be overcome. Even with the best of intentions of Hans, these difficulties were almost insurmountable. Lost in thought, but also seeking help, he stared the whole time with uneasily twinkling eyes at Kay. Until father left, he couldn't say anything to mother. Otherwise father would find out, and it would be all over. So he could only mention it later. But even then, out of consideration for his mother, he would have to ask her consent, not quickly and all of a sudden, but slowly and on some suitable occasion. And only then could he come to get Kay. But wouldn't that be too late? Wouldn't his father's return be already dangerously imminent? Indeed, it couldn't be done. But Kay showed that it could be done. There was no reason to fear there not being enough time. A short conversation, a short meeting would be enough. And Hans needn't come for Kay. Kay would wait in hiding somewhere near the house, and at a sign from Hans he would come at once. No, said Hans. Kay shouldn't wait near the house. Once again, it was his sensitivity about his mother that ruled him. Without mother's knowledge, Kay shouldn't set out on his way. He, Hans, shouldn't enter into any such agreement which left out mother. He must come and get Kay from the school, but not before mother knew of it and gave her permission. Fine, said Kay. Then it was really dangerous, for it was conceivable that Hans's father would catch him in the house, and, even if this didn't happen, his mother would fear as much and wouldn't let Hans go, and so the whole plan would fail because of his father. Here again Hans objected, and in this way the argument went back and forth. Some time ago Kay had called over Hans, who was seated in the bench, to the teacher's desk, pulled him between his knees, and patted him soothingly a few times. And despite some resistance from Hans, this closeness actually helped them to come to an understanding. They finally agreed to the following. Hans would first tell his mother the whole truth,
but to make it easier for her to give her consent, he would add that Kay also wanted to speak with Brunswick himself, not about Hans's mother, but about his own affairs. That was true, too. During the conversation, it had occurred to Kay that Brunswick, no matter how dangerous and evil a person he was in other respects, couldn't really be his adversary. For he was, after all, at least according to the council chairman's report, the leader of the faction that had, even if merely on political grounds, demanded the summoning of a surveyor. So Brunswick must have welcomed Kay's arrival in the village. But then the irritated greeting from him that first day and the dislike of which Hans had spoken were almost incomprehensible. But perhaps Brunswick felt hurt precisely because Kay hadn't turned first to him for help. Perhaps there was some other misunderstanding that could be resolved in a few words. Once that was done, though, Kay could surely count on Brunswick for support against the teacher, and even against the council chairman. All the official chicanery, what else could you call it, with which the council chairman and the teacher kept him from the castle authorities and forced him to take the janitorial post could be exposed. And if it soon came to a fight between Brunswick and the council chairman over Kay, then Brunswick would have to take Kay on his side. Kay would be a guest in Brunswick's house. Brunswick's means of combat would be placed at his disposal in defiance of the council chairman. Who knows how far he would get in this way? And in any case, he would often be near the woman. Thus he played with his dreams, and they with him, while Hans, thinking only of his mother, observed Kay's silence with concern, just as one does with a doctor who is lost in thought in an effort to find a cure for a serious case. Kay's proposal to speak to Brunswick about the surveyor position met with Hans's approval, though only because it ensured his mother some protection from his father and, besides, merely concerned an emergency situation that would hopefully never come about. Hans simply asked how Kay would explain the late hour of his visit to his father, and finally contented himself, if with a slightly glum face, with Kay's statement that the unbearable janitorial post and dishonourable treatment by the teacher had, in a sudden attack of despair, made him lose all sense of consideration. Then, when everything had been thus considered, in so far as one could see, and the possibility of success could at least no longer be ruled out, Hans, relieved of his burdensome reflections, became more cheerful, chattered childishly for a while, first with Kay and then also with Frieda, who had sat there a long time, as though thinking of entirely different matters, and only now began to take part in the conversation again. Among other things, she asked him what he wanted to be. He didn't think for long before saying that he wanted to be a man like Kay. Then, when asked why, he naturally couldn't answer, and the question whether he wanted to be a janitor, for instance, he answered with an emphatic no. It was only after further questioning that one noticed in what a roundabout way he had obtained his wish. Kay's current situation was not so much enviable as sad and contemptible. Hans, too, saw this clearly himself and didn't have to observe others to make it out. He would have dearly liked to preserve his mother from every look and every word of Kay's. Nevertheless, he came to Kay and asked him for help, and would be happy if Kay agreed to this. In others, too, he detected something similar, and his mother especially had spoken of Kay. This contradiction led him to believe that Kay, low and frightening though he was right now, would, if only in the almost inconceivably distant future, outstrip everyone else. And it was precisely this absolutely foolish distance and the proud development it was supposed to usher in that tempted Hans. To gain this prize, he was even prepared to make allowances for Kay as he currently was. What was so especially childish and precocious about this wish was that Hans looked down on Kay as though on a younger child whose future extended beyond his own, the future of a small boy. And it was with an almost bleak gravity, after insistent questioning by Frieda, that he spoke of these matters. It took Kay to cheer him up by saying that he knew what it was Hans envied him for, namely Kay's beautiful knobby walking stick, which lay on the table and which Hans had absent-mindedly played with during the conversation. Well, Kay knew how to make walking sticks like that, and once their plan had worked, he would make an even more beautiful one for Hans. It was no longer entirely clear that Hans hadn't simply been thinking of the walking stick, so pleased was he with Kay's promise, and he cheerfully took his leave, though not before pressing Kay's hand firmly and saying, "So the day after tomorrow, then." Chapter 14. Frieda's Reproach. It was high time Hans left, for before long the teacher flung open the door and, on seeing Kay and Frieda sitting quietly at the table, shouted, "Excuse the disturbance, but tell me, when are you finally going to tidy up in here?
We must sit packed together next door. It's bad for the teaching, but you lie about and stretch out in the big gymnasium, and to make even more room for yourselves, you have even sent away the assistants. The least you can do now is stand up and get a move on. And to Kay alone, and you, bring me my luncheon from the Bridge Inn. He had shouted all this angrily, but the words themselves were relatively mild, even the rather crude form of address. Though Kay was instantly ready to comply, simply in order to sound out the teacher, he said, "But I'm dismissed." "Dismissed or not dismissed, bring me my luncheon," said the teacher. "Dismissed or not dismissed, that's precisely what I want to know," said Kay. "What are you talking about?" said the teacher. "You never accepted the dismissal." "So that's enough to set it aside?" asked Kay. "Not for me," said the teacher. "Believe me when I say so, though it is enough for the council chairman, quite incomprehensibly so. But now run along, otherwise you'll really end up being thrown out." Kay was satisfied. So in the meantime, the teacher had spoken to the council chairman. Or could it be that he hadn't even spoken to him, but had simply adopted the chairman's probable opinion, which was in Kay's favour? Now Kay wanted to rush out at once for the luncheon, but the teacher called him back from the corridor, either because he had merely wanted to test Kay's willingness to carry out his duty by giving this special order in order to be able to respond accordingly in the future, or because he once again felt like giving orders, for he liked making Kay run off at an order from him and then wheel about just as quickly, like a waiter. Kay, for his part, knew that by giving in too much he would turn himself into the teacher's slave and whipping boy, but he intended to accept the teacher's moods patiently up to a certain point, for if the teacher couldn't legally dismiss him, as had just become clear, then he could certainly make the position unbearably excruciating. But this position meant more to Kay now than it had before. The conversation with Hans had given him new, admittedly unlikely, entirely baseless, but no longer forgettable hopes, the even half-obscured Barnabas. If he tried to pursue them, and he had no other choice, then he would have to gather all his strength and not worry about anything else, about food, housing, the village authorities, not even about Frieda. And this was essentially all about Frieda, because everything else mattered to him only with regard to her. So he would have to try to hold on to this position, which gave Frieda some security, and he ought not to regret that with this goal in mind, he would have to put up with more of the teacher than he could have forced himself to put up with otherwise. All this wasn't too painful. It was part of the series of life's endless little sufferings. It was nothing in comparison with what Kay was striving for. He had not come here in order to lead a life in honour and peace. And so, just as he had immediately wanted to run to the inn, on hearing the new order, he was immediately ready to tidy up the room so that the schoolmistress could come over again with her class. But everything had to be tidied up quickly, since Kay was then supposed to fetch the luncheon, and the teacher was already quite hungry and thirsty. Kay assured him that everything would be done exactly as he had wished. For a moment the teacher watched as Kay rushed about, putting away the bedding, straightening out the gymnastic equipment, sweeping up quickly while Frieda washed and scrubbed the podium. This eagerness seemed to satisfy the teacher. He pointed out that outside the door there was a pile of firewood for the stove. He was probably determined not to let Kay set foot in the shed again, and then, after threatening that he would be back soon to check, he went over to the children. After working in silence for a while, Frieda asked Kay why he was giving in so much to the teacher. This was probably a concerned and compassionate question, but Kay, who was thinking of how poorly, given her original promise, Frieda had succeeded in shielding him from the imperiousness and aggression of the teacher, simply said curtly that now, since he had become a janitor, he would have to carry out the duties of the post. Then there was silence again until Kay, reminded by this brief exchange that Frieda had been lost in anxious thought for some time now, especially during almost the entire conversation with Hans, asked her openly, as he was carrying in the wood, what she was worried about. She answered, raising her face slowly toward him, that it was nothing in particular. She was simply thinking of the landlady and of the truth of certain things she had said. Only at Kay's insistence, after refusing several times, did she answer in greater detail, but without interrupting her work, not out of diligence, for the work wasn't advancing at all, but only so that she wouldn't be obliged to look at Kay. And now she described how, at first, she had listened calmly to Kay's conversation with Hans, but then, startled by certain words of Kay's, she had begun to get a clearer sense of the meaning of his words, and how from then on she couldn't avoid hearing in Kay's words the confirmation of a warning she had the landlady to thank for, though she certainly hadn't wanted to admit it was justified. Annoyed by these vague generalities, and more irritated than moved by Frieda's tearfully plaintive voice,
especially since the landlady was again interfering in his life, by means of memories at any rate, for until now she hadn't had much success in person, Kay threw the wood he was holding in his arms on the floor, sat down on it, and asked gravely for clarification.
"Quite often," Frida began. "Right from the start, the landlady tried to make me doubt you. She didn't claim that you're lying. On the contrary, she said you are childishly open, but by nature so different from us that even when you're speaking openly, we can barely bring ourselves to believe you. And if a certain good friend of ours doesn't rescue us first, we will have to find out how true this is through bitter experience. Despite her keen eye for people, even she has gone through something similar. But after her last conversation with you at the Bridge Inn, and I'm simply repeating her malicious words, she caught on to you. Then you couldn't deceive her any more, even though you made a great effort to hide your intentions. 'But he's not hiding anything,' she said again and again, and then she added, 'Do make an effort sometime to listen to him properly, not just superficially. No, really listen to him.' That's all she had done, and she had been able to make out something like the following concerning me. 'You cozied up to me,' she actually used that shameful expression, 'simply because I happened to cross your path, wasn't exactly displeasing to you, and because you quite mistakenly think that a barmaid is preordained to be the victim of every guest who reaches out a hand. Besides, as the landlady learned from the landlord at the Gentleman's Inn, for some reason you were determined to spend the night at the Gentleman's Inn, and yet the only way that could be accomplished was through me. Now all this would have been a sufficiently good reason to take you as my lover for that one night, but if more was to come of it, more was needed, and that more was Clam. The landlady doesn't claim to know what it is you want from Clam. She merely claims that before getting to know me, you sought to reach Clam just as eagerly as you've been doing ever since. The only difference was that back then you had no hope, while now you thought that in me you had a reliable means of really penetrating through to Clam without delay, and even with a certain amount of superiority. How startled I was, but only for a moment, and without having any particularly deep reason, when at one point today you said that before getting to know me you were adrift here. Those are perhaps the same words the landlady used. She, too, says it's only since getting to know me that you have become conscious of your goal. That was because you believed that in me you had conquered a mistress of Clam's, and thus had a pawn that could be redeemed only at the highest price. Negotiating about this price with Clam was your sole aim. Since I mean nothing to you and the price everything, you're ready for every compromise concerning me, but remain stubborn concerning the price. So you couldn't care less about my loss of the position at the Gentleman's Inn. Couldn't care less about my having to leave the Bridge Inn. Couldn't care less about all the heavy janitorial work that I will have to do. You have no tenderness, let alone time, for me. You leave me to the assistants. You don't feel jealous. The only value I have in your eyes is that I was Clam's mistress. In your ignorance, you try to ensure that I do not forget Clam, so that in the end I don't put up too much resistance when the decisive moment arrives. But you also fight with the landlady, the only person you think capable of tearing me from you, and that's why you carry the fight with her to such extremes, in order to make it necessary for you to leave the Bridge Inn with me. You have absolutely no doubt that I myself am, in so far as it's simply a question of me, and no matter what happens, your property. You think of the interview with Clam as a business, cash for cash. You're counting on every possibility. You're ready to do anything, provided you get your price. If Clam wants me, you'll give me back to him. If he wants you to stay with me, you'll stay. If he wants you to cast me out, you'll cast me out. But you're also prepared to put on a comedy, and if it's to your advantage, you'll pretend to love me. You'll try to combat his indifference by stressing your own insignificance and by shaming him with the fact that you're his successor, or with tales of my confessions of love for him, which I did indeed make, and you'll ask him to take me back, but only on payment of your price. And if nothing else works, then you'll simply beg on behalf of the married couple, the Kays. And then, the landlady said in conclusion, if you see that you've been wrong about everything, about your assumptions, your hopes, your notion of Clam and of his relations with me, then my true hell will begin. Then, even more than before, I shall be your only possession, on which you are dependent, but at the same time a possession that has proved to be worthless, and that you'll treat accordingly, since the only feeling you have for me is as the proprietor. Intently, with compressed lips, Kay had listened. The logs beneath him had begun to roll. He had almost slipped onto the floor, had paid no attention to that, and only now got up, sat on the podium, took Frida's hand, which she feebly attempted to withdraw, and said, "In the account you gave, I couldn't always distinguish your opinion from the landlady's." "It was only the landlady's opinion," said Frida. "I listened to it all because I admire the landlady, but it was the first time in my life that I utterly rejected her opinion.
Everything she said seemed so pathetic to me, so far removed from any real understanding of how things were with the two of us. The complete opposite of what she said seemed more likely to me. I thought of the bleak morning after our first night, how you knelt beside me looking as though everything were already lost, and how eventually, no matter how hard I tried, I wasn't helping you, but rather hindering you. It was because of me that the landlady became your enemy, a powerful enemy, whom you still underestimate. It was for my sake, because I was in your care, that you had to fight for your position, that you were at a disadvantage in your dealings with the council chairman, that you had to submit to the teacher, that you were at the assistant's mercy. But worst of all, it was for my sake that you may have committed an offence against Clam. Your constant efforts to reach Clam were nothing but an ineffectual striving to appease him in some way, and I told myself that the landlady, who surely knew far more about this than I did, was merely attempting with her blandishments to ensure that I didn't reproach myself too seriously. A well-meant but superfluous effort. My love for you would have helped me to overcome everything, and in the end would also have taken you further, if not in the village, then somewhere else. It had, of course, already demonstrated its strength. It saved you from the Barnabas family.
So that was your objection, then, said Kay. And in the meantime, what has changed?
I don't know, Frida said, and she glanced at Kay's hand, which was holding hers. Perhaps nothing has changed. When you're so close to me and you ask so quietly, then I think nothing has changed. But in reality...
She withdrew her hand from Kay, sat erect across from him, and wept without covering her face. Spontaneously she turned her tear-streaked face toward him, not as though she were weeping about herself and therefore had nothing to hide, but rather as if she were weeping about Kay's betrayal, and he therefore deserved the miserable look on her face.
But in reality everything has changed from the moment I heard you talking to the boy. How innocently you began. You asked about the situation at home, about this person and that. It seemed to me as though you had just come to the inn. You were so affectionate, so open-hearted, and sought my eye with such childlike eagerness. It was just the way it used to be, and all I wished was that the landlady were here, listening to you and still trying to stick to her opinion. But then all of a sudden, I don't know how it happened, I understood what your intention was in speaking to the boy. With your sympathetic words you gained his confidence, which isn't easy to do, so that you could quietly pursue your goal, which had become increasingly clear to me. That woman was your goal. The only thing that emerged clearly from your remarks, seemingly so full of concern for her, was your devotion to your own affairs. You deceived that woman even before you won her. In your words I heard not only my past, but also my future. I felt as though the landlady were sitting beside me explaining everything, and I were trying with all my strength to push her away. But now I see clearly the hopelessness of such efforts, and indeed it was no longer I who was being deceived. I wasn't even being deceived, but rather that strange woman. And then, when I pulled myself together and asked Hans what he wanted to be, and he said he wanted to be like you, and was therefore already entirely yours, what was the big difference between him, the good boy who was mistreated here, and me, then, at the inn?
Everything, said Kay, who, in being accustomed to the reproach, had pulled himself together. Everything you say is in a sense right, it is not wrong, only it is hostile. Those are the landlady's thoughts, those of my enemy, even if you think they're your own, which I find reassuring. But they are instructive. The landlady is still capable of teaching one a thing or two. She didn't tell me this directly, though she certainly hasn't spared me in other ways. She obviously entrusted this weapon to you in hopes that you would make use of it at a particularly bad or decisive hour. If I mistreat you, then she mistreats you in the same way. But, Frida, just think. Even if everything were exactly as the landlady says, that would be terrible only in one case, namely, if you're not fond of me. Then, well, then it would really be true that I won you by means of calculation and wiles, so that I would make a huge profit from this possession. So perhaps it was even part of my plan that I came before you arm in arm with Olga in order to arouse your pity, and that the landlady simply forgot to include this in her tally of my guilt. Yet, if it isn't such a dreadful case, and a sly beast of prey didn't drag you away, but instead you came toward me as I came toward you, and in this way we found each other, both oblivious to everything else, tell me, Frida, what then? Then I am, after all, not only furthering my own cause, but yours too. There's no difference between them, and only a certain enemy of ours can distinguish between them. This is true everywhere, even with Hans. Besides, with your delicacy of feeling, you exaggerate greatly in assessing the conversation with Hans.
for if Hans's intentions and mine don't entirely coincide, that still doesn't mean there's a contradiction between them. Besides, our disagreement wasn't lost on Hans. If you thought so, you would be seriously underestimating that cautious little fellow. And even if everything remained hidden from him, it still wouldn't do anybody any harm, I hope.
It's so difficult, Kay, to get one's bearings, said Frieda, sighing. I certainly don't distrust you, and if anything of that sort has come down to me from the landlady, I shall gladly cast it off and kneel down to beg your forgiveness, as I'm actually doing the whole time, even if I do say such dreadful things. It's true, though, that you keep many secrets from me. You come and you go, I don't know where from and where to. When Hans knocked, you even called out Barnabas's name. If only you had called me, even once as lovingly as you did then, for reasons I couldn't understand, called that hated name. If you have no faith in me, why shouldn't I become distrustful? For then I'm completely dependent on the landlady, and your conduct merely confirms her opinion. Not in everything. I'm not claiming you confirm everything, she says, since you did drive away the assistants for my sake, didn't you? Oh, if only you knew the longing with which I search for a decent core for myself in everything you do and say, even if it torments me.
First of all, Frieda, said Kay, I'm not hiding the slightest thing from you. How the landlady hates me, and how she tries to wrench you away from me with such despicable methods, and how you give in to her, Frieda. Oh, how you give in to her. But tell me, what is it I am hiding from you? I want to reach Clam, this you know. You cannot help me achieve this, and I must therefore take matters into my own hands. This you also know. I still haven't had any success, this you can see. Should I now, in describing my useless efforts, which in reality are already sufficiently humiliating, humiliate myself twice over? Should I, say, brag about having waited in vain an entire afternoon, freezing at the door of Clam's sleigh? Delighted that I no longer had to think of such things, I hurried over to you, only to have to listen to all these threats from you. And Barnabas? Certainly, I am expecting him. He is Clam's messenger. I didn't appoint him.
Barnabas again, cried Frieda. I cannot believe that he is a good messenger.
Perhaps you're right, said Kay, but he's the only messenger who is sent to me.
Too bad, said Frieda. Then you should be all the more wary of him.
Unfortunately, he has given me no cause for that, said Kay, smiling. He rarely comes, and what he brings is insignificant. It's valuable only because it comes directly from Clam.
But look, said Frieda, you're no longer even aiming for Clam. Perhaps that's what upsets me most. It was bad enough that you were always pushing past me to Clam, but that now you seem to be turning away from Clam is far worse. It's something not even the landlady could have foreseen. According to the landlady, my happiness, my questionable but nonetheless very real happiness, would end on the day you finally realized that your hope for Clam was futile. But now you're no longer even waiting for that day. All of a sudden a little boy comes in and you start fighting with him over his mother, as if you were fighting for the air you need to live.
You've understood my conversation with Hans correctly, said Kay. That's how it was. But do you think your entire earlier life is so submerged, except, of course, for the landlady, who won't let herself be forced down with it, that you no longer know how hard one must fight to get ahead, especially if one is coming up from the depths? How one must use everything that can somehow give one hope? And this woman comes from the castle. She herself told me so when I wandered into Lazarman's that first day. What was more natural than to ask her for advice or even for help? If the landlady only knows the obstacles that keep one from Clam, then this woman probably knows the way, for that's how she herself came down.
The way to Clam? Frieda asked.
To Clam, of course. Where else? Said Kay. Then he jumped up. But now it's high time to get that luncheon. Urgently, more insistently than was called for, Frieda asked him to stay, as though all the consoling things he had said to her would be confirmed only if he stayed. But Kay reminded her about the teacher, pointed to the door, which at any moment could burst open with a sound like thunder, and also promised he would soon be back. She needn't even light the stove, he would see to it himself. Finally, Frieda submitted silently. Once Kay was outside, trudging through the snow, the path should have been cleared long ago, strange how slowly the work was going, he saw one of the assistants, dead tired, clinging to the fence. Only one. Where was the other? Had Kay at least exhausted the staying power of one of them? The fellow still left certainly had lost none of his zeal. One could see this when, animated by Kay's gaze, he immediately began to stretch out his arms and roll his eyes longingly. His stubbornness is exemplary, Kay said to himself, though he had to add, still it's making him freeze at the fence.
Outwardly, all Kay had for the assistant was a raised, threatening fist, which prevented any approach. Indeed, the assistant anxiously backed off a considerable distance. Just then, Frida opened a window, as had been agreed upon with Kay, in order to air the place before lighting the stove. Instantly, the assistant stopped bothering Kay, and then, irresistibly attracted, crept toward the window. With a face contorted by friendliness toward the assistants and pleading helplessness toward Kay, she gave a little wave from the upstairs window. It wasn't even clear whether this was a dismissal or a greeting. The assistant did not let it deter him from approaching. Then Frida hastily closed the outer window, but remained behind it, with her hand on the latch, head turned sideways, eyes wide open, and a fixed smile. Did she realize that she was luring the assistant rather than frightening him away? But Kay didn't look round again. He wanted to hurry as much as possible and come back soon. Chapter 15. At Amalia's. Finally, it was already dark, late afternoon. Kay had cleared the garden path, piled the snow on both sides, beaten it down, and was now finished with the day's work. He stood at the garden gate, the only person anywhere around. He had driven away the assistant hours ago, chased him a great distance. Then the assistant had hidden himself somewhere between the little garden and the sheds, simply wasn't to be found, and hadn't come out since. Frida was at home, already washing the clothes or still at work on Gisa's cat. It was a sign of great trust on Gisa's part that she had turned this task over to Frida, an unappetizing and unsuitable task, and Kay certainly wouldn't have tolerated Frida's undertaking it had it not been quite advisable, after their various derelictions of duty, to use every opportunity to make Gisa feel obliged to them. Gisa had watched with pleasure as Kay carried the small children's tub down from the attic, as water was warmed up and as, finally, with great care, they lifted the cat into the tub. And then Gisa had even left the cat entirely in Frida's care, since Schwarzer, Kay's acquaintance from the first evening, had appeared, greeted Kay with a mixture of diffidence, for which the foundation had been laid that evening, and the unbridled contempt that befits a mere janitor, and then gone into the other schoolroom with Gisa. The two of them were still there. According to what Kay had been told at the Bridge Inn, Schwarzer, who was, after all, the son of a steward, had, out of love for Gisa, been living for some time now in the village, and had succeeded, through his connections, in getting the council to appoint him to the post of assistant teacher, but had chiefly discharged those duties by almost never missing Gisa's classes, where he sat on a bench between the children, or, preferably, on the podium at Gisa's feet. This was no longer a distraction. The children had long since grown used to it, perhaps all the more readily given that Schwarzer showed no affection for, nor understanding of, children, barely spoke to them, having merely taken over Gisa's gymnastics class and being otherwise content to live in the proximity, the air, the warmth of Gisa. His greatest pleasure was to sit next to Gisa, correcting copybooks with her. Today, too, they were busy with the same task. Schwarzer had brought along a large pile of copybooks. The teacher always gave them his, too, and while it was still light outside, Kay had seen the two of them working over a small table, their heads close together, immobile. All one could see there now were two flickering candles. It was a serious, silent love that united the two, its tone, in fact, set by Gisa, whose lethargic being sometimes went wild and broke all bounds, but who, on any other occasion, would never have tolerated anything of the sort from others. And so even the lively Schwarzer was obliged to comply and to walk slowly, speak slowly, be silent much of the time. But for all this he was, as one could see, amply rewarded with Gisa's simple, calm presence. At the same time, Gisa may not have loved him at all. At any rate, her round and literally unblinking grey eyes, in which only the pupils seemed to move, gave no answer to such questions. Though one could see that she tolerated Schwarzer without protest, she certainly didn't know how to appreciate the honour of being loved by the son of a steward, and always carried her full, voluptuous body in the same quiet manner, whether Schwarzer was following her with his eyes or not. Schwarzer, on the other hand, constantly made for her the sacrifice of remaining in the village. The messengers from his father, who often came to pick him up, he dismissed with great anger, as if such brief reminders of the castle and of his duty as a son were seriously, irreparably compromising his happiness. And yet he actually had a great deal of free time, for Gisa generally let him see her only during classes and copybook corrections, though not out of calculation, but simply because she particularly valued comfort and thus solitude, and was probably happiest at home, completely free, stretched out on the settee with the cat, which wouldn't disturb her, for it could now barely move.
and so Schwarzer wandered about most of the day with nothing to do. But he liked that too, since it gave him an opportunity, which he often took advantage of, to go to Lion Street, where Gisa lived, to climb the stairs to her small attic room, to listen at her always locked door, and then to leave, having always noticed in the room the most perfect, inexplicable silence. Still, even in him, the consequences of this kind of life occasionally manifested themselves, though never in Gisa's presence, in the form of briefly rekindled, ridiculous outbursts of official arrogance, which were not exactly suited to his present position. And then things certainly didn't turn out well, as Kay knew from experience.
The only astonishing thing was that people, at least those at the Bridge Inn, still spoke of Schwarzer with a certain respect, even concerning matters that were more ridiculous than significant. And this respect also extended to Gisa. But still it was wrong that Schwarzer should think that he, an assistant teacher, was greatly superior to Kay. There was no such superiority. A janitor is an important person for the teaching staff, even for a teacher such as Schwarzer. And if one cannot avoid despising him for reasons of social class, then one should at least make one's disdain more tolerable by providing him with something suitable in return. Kay intended to think about this some other time. Besides, Schwarzer was indebted to him since that first evening, and the fact that the following few days had justified Schwarzer's reception of him didn't lessen that debt. For the thing to remember here was that his reception may have set the course for all subsequent events. Because of Schwarzer, the full attention of the authorities had focused on Kay right away in that first hour, rather absurdly so, for he was a complete stranger then in the village, without acquaintances, without a refuge, exhausted after the long walk, lying utterly helpless on the straw mattress, at the mercy of each official intervention. Had it been only one night later, everything would have happened differently, smoothly, virtually out of sight. In any case, nobody would have known about him, and they wouldn't have become suspicious or hesitated before letting him spend a day here as a journeyman. They would have noticed his usefulness and reliability. The news about him would have spread throughout the neighbourhood, and he would probably have soon found a place somewhere as a farmhand. Of course, he would not have evaded the authorities, but there was a great difference between the main office, or whoever came to the telephone there, being aroused in the middle of the night and pressured into making an immediate decision. Yes, pressured, seemingly with humility but actually with annoying persistence, by none other than Schwarzer, who was probably unpopular up at the castle. A great difference between that and Kay himself knocking on the door at the council chairman's during office hours the following day and registering as a foreign journeyman who had already found a place to sleep at a local citizen's and would probably continue his journey next day, unless, and this was most unlikely, he found work here, but then only for a few days, since he hadn't the slightest intention of staying longer. This is what would have happened, or something of that sort, had it not been for Schwarzer. The authorities would have gone on dealing with the matter, but calmly, through official channels, unruffled by the impatience of the individual party, whom they probably considered especially repugnant. Well, of course, Kay was innocent in all this. The guilt lay with Schwarzer. But Schwarzer was the son of a steward, and outwardly he had indeed behaved correctly, so they could make Kay alone pay for it. And what was the ridiculous reason for all this? Perhaps a bad-tempered mood of Gisa's that day, owing to which Schwarzer couldn't sleep and roamed about at night before finally taking out his woes on Kay. Of course, from another point of view, you could argue that Kay owed a great deal to Schwarzer's behaviour. Only in that way had something become possible that Kay would never have achieved on his own, would never have dared to attempt, and that the authorities, for their part, would scarcely have admitted. Namely, he had approached the authorities without making any shady moves, face to face, openly, insofar as this was at all possible with them. But that was a terrible gift. True, it spared Kay a great many lies and deceptions, but it also deprived him of almost all his defences, hampered him in the struggle, and would have made him despair if he had not been obliged to tell himself that the difference between himself and the authorities, in terms of power, was so enormous that all the lies and cunning he would have been capable of wouldn't have produced any significant reduction of that difference to his advantage, and would necessarily have had to remain more or less negligible. But this was merely a thought with which Kay was consoling himself. Schwarzer nevertheless owed him a favour. If he had harmed Kay earlier, perhaps he could help in the near future. Kay would continue to need help with the most trivial tasks, with the very first preconditions, since even Barnabas seemed to have failed. For Frieda's sake, Kay had been reluctant to call at Barnabas's to make inquiries. So as not to have to receive him in front of Frieda, he had worked outside and had stayed on here after work, waiting for Barnabas, but Barnabas hadn't come.
Well, the only course left was to go to the sisters, but only for a little while. He would simply ask them from the threshold. He would be back before long. And he rammed the shovel into the snow and ran. Breathless, he arrived at Barnabas's house, knocked quickly, flung open the door, and, without glancing around the room, asked, "Hasn't Barnabas come?" It was only then he noticed that Olga wasn't there, that the two old people were once again sitting half asleep at a far-off table, that they hadn't realized yet what happened at the door and were slow to turn their heads, and, finally, that Amalia lay on the bench by the stove, covered with a few blankets, and, in her initial fright at Kay's appearance, started and put her hand on her forehead in order to pull herself together. Had Olga been here, she would have answered immediately, and Kay could have left. But now he had to take those few steps over to Amalia, hold out his hand, which she silently pressed, and ask that she prevent her startled parents from wandering about, which she did with a couple of words. Kay learned that Olga was chopping wood in the courtyard, and that Amalia, who was exhausted, she didn't say why, had had to lie down a short while ago, and though Barnabas still hadn't come, he would have to come soon, for he never stayed overnight at the castle. Kay thanked her for the information. Now he could go. But Amalia asked whether he would wait a moment for Olga. Unfortunately, he no longer had time. And then Amalia asked whether he had already talked to Olga today. He said no, in astonishment, and asked whether Olga had anything special to tell him. Amalia screwed up her mouth, as though she were slightly annoyed, nodded silently to Kay. This was clearly a signal for him to leave, and lay back down again. From her reclining position, she scrutinized him, as though surprised he was still there. Her gaze was cold, clear, as immobile as ever. It wasn't directly fixed on what she was observing, but instead, and this was unsettling, went past it, only slightly, ever so imperceptibly, but undeniably so. It didn't seem to be weakness, embarrassment, or dishonesty that caused this, but rather a constant desire for solitude that dominated all other feelings and that she herself had perhaps only become conscious of in this way. Kay thought he recalled that he had already been preoccupied by that gaze the first evening, and that the disagreeable impression this family had instantly created was probably due to that gaze, which was not inherently disagreeable, but rather proud and honest in its reserve. "You're always so sad, Amalia," said Kay. "Is there something tormenting you? Can't you tell me what it is? I have never seen a country girl like you. This has only just occurred to me today, right now. Are you from the village? Were you born here?" Amalia said yes, as if Kay had asked only the second question. And then she said, "So you will wait for Olga?" "I don't know why you keep asking me the same question," said Kay. "I cannot stay because my fiancé is waiting for me at home." Amalia was leaning on her elbow. She had never heard of his fiancé. Kay mentioned her name. Amalia did not know her. She asked whether Olga knew of the engagement. Kay thought she probably knew. Olga had actually seen him with Frida. Besides, news like that spread quickly in the village. But Amalia assured him that Olga knew nothing of this, and that it would make her very unhappy, since she seemed to be in love with Kay. She hadn't spoken openly about this, for she was quite reserved, but then love always betrays itself involuntarily. Kay said he was convinced that Amalia was mistaken. Amalia smiled, and her smile, sad though it was, brightened her bleak, drawn face, made her silence eloquent and her strangeness familiar. It was the surrender of a secret, the surrender of some hitherto closely guarded possession that could be reclaimed, but never fully. Amalia said she certainly wasn't mistaken. She knew even more than that. She knew, for instance, that Kay was also fond of Olga, and that his visits, supposedly for some messages of Barnabas's, were actually intended for Olga alone. But now that Amalia knew everything, he needn't be so strict and could come by often. That's all she had wanted to tell him. Kay shook his head and reminded her of the engagement. Amalia didn't seem to waste much thought on the engagement. The immediate impression of Kay standing alone there was decisive for her. She merely asked when Kay had met the girl, for he had been in the village only a few days. Kay mentioned his going that evening to the gentleman's inn, upon which Amalia merely said curtly that she was very much against his being taken to the gentleman's inn. Turning to Olga, who came in just then with an armful of wood, she asked for confirmation. Olga, refreshed and fortified by the cold air, seemed vigorous and energetic, as if transformed by work very different in nature from her usual lethargic standing about in this room. She threw down the wood, greeted Kay boldly, and immediately asked about Frida. Kay gave Amalia a meaningful look, but she did not seem to think that her opinion had been refuted.
A little irritated about this, Kay spoke of Frida in greater detail than he might otherwise have done, described the difficult conditions under which she had successfully run a household of sorts in the schoolhouse, and became so carried away in his haste to finish his account, he really wanted to go home at once, that by way of saying goodbye he invited the sisters to visit him sometime. But here he started and faltered, while Amalia immediately announced, without letting him say a word, that she would accept the invitation. Olga also had to go along with this, and did so. Yet Kay, hard-pressed because of the need to leave quickly, and also uneasy under Amalia's scrutiny, did not hesitate to admit without further embroidery that the invitation was ill-considered, having been prompted solely by personal sentiments, and that unfortunately he couldn't honour it because of the great enmity between Frida and the Barnabas household, which he found incomprehensible. "It isn't enmity," said Amalia, getting up from the bench and throwing the blanket down behind her. "It's nothing that significant, only a slavish repetition of common opinion. And so go now. Go to your fiancé. I can see you're in a hurry. Besides, you needn't fear our coming to visit. I first said yes, but only as a joke, out of malice. But you can come to see us often. There's surely nothing to prevent that. And you can always use Barnabas's messages as a pretext. I will make this even easier for you by telling you that even if Barnabas does bring you a message from the castle, he can no longer take it all the way to the school. He cannot run about so much, poor boy. His duties are wearing him out. You will have to come yourself to pick up your messages." Kay had never heard Amalia speak continuously at such length. It even sounded different from her normal speech, for it had a certain majesty, which was felt not only by Kay, but apparently also by Olga, her sister, who was, after all, well used to her. She stood a little to the side, hands in her lap, once again in her usual posture, legs apart, slightly stooped, keeping her eyes fixed on Amalia, who was looking only at Kay. "It's a mistake," said Kay. "A great mistake if you think I'm not serious about waiting for Barnabas. My greatest, and indeed my only wish, is to settle my affairs with the authorities. And Barnabas should help me to accomplish this. Many of my hopes lie with him. True, he has disappointed me greatly, but that was more my fault than his. In the confusion of the first few hours, I thought I could accomplish everything by means of a short evening walk, and when the impossible proved impossible, I blamed him for it. It even affected my opinion of your family and of you. But that's over. I think I can understand you better now. You're even..." Kay was searching for the right word, but couldn't find it right away, and made do with a rough equivalent. "Perhaps you're more good-natured than any of the other villagers, more so at least than the ones I have met so far."
This book is continued on Disc 6.